From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 5th, 1981. The Centers for Disease Control published its first report of 5 cases of pneumocystis pneumonia in gay men in Los Angeles and New York City. A doctor in Rochester, Bill Valenti, flagged the report and placed it in a file folder he labeled Infectious Diseases Other. It was too early to call this a new disease, but the descriptions were both interesting and troubling. And as you might have guessed, this was part of the opening chapter in the story of AIDS in America. The medical community had to first understand what it was. Then there was stigma, shame, families coming apart, partners left without benefits, and more. And through it all, Dr. Bill Valenti has been at the forefront of much of the treatment, the approach, the research, the understanding. There's a movement to eliminate AIDS by 2020, something that might have seemed absurd just a couple of decades ago. And Dr. Valenti has a memoir that tells this harrowing tale. The book is called AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. And Dr. Bill Valenti is my guest. And I got to say, Bill, you know, I think it was a few years. It took me a little while in this community before I realized how big a deal you are. You're going to hate hearing me say that, but I have to say that. I mean, you've been a really remarkable figure in the fight against AIDS from the very beginning. So congratulations on the book, and thank you for being here.
Good. Well, and thank you for your for allowing me to tell the story over the years. My father reminded me a long time ago that I should always at least acknowledge my collaborators because he realized that I had a short attention span and big ideas.
Well, there's even a little moment in the book where I think you were in a WXXI studio in the 1980s where you tangled with So we're going to get to that. There's a lot I want to talk about. But I want to tell you what's coming up here because, again, the book is called AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. I think it's important if you care about this community, if you care about this kind of story and why it matters to our history. And the story is told in a really digestible way, you know, a lot of personal, I would say personal, stories of patients, really touching stories that we're going to talk about this hour, but it's very digestible, it's very accessible, and there's a book signing event coming up Wednesday, that's the 19th of April, and that is, so next Wednesday at Apogee Wine Bar at 5:30 p.m., you can meet Bill there. You can get books available for purchase right now, either at drvalenti.com, V-A-L-E-N-T-I, or TrilliumHealth.org, and all the proceeds benefit Trillium Health's End the HIV Epidemic by 2020. There's also, of course, the White Party, which is coming up in July, which is always a good time, right, Bill?
Exactly.
So you can get tickets for that, and you can find them on Facebook at Trillium Health. So a lot of ways to access the book. When did you decide you wanted to write this memoir, and why, Bill?
Well, probably 35 years ago. I mean, the stories have been going through my head for a very long time. Dr. Ann Griep, at that time Zettelmeyer, was our AIDS program psychiatrist. We became very good personal friends, and we used to talk about writing a book. She said, you should write a book and write these stories down. A year ago, one of the stories that's in the book involved one of the patient's children grew up and graduated from high school and got a scholarship to Columbia University. And when they told me about that, I thought it was like having my own kid accepted at Columbia. So it was kind of a pivotal moment and thought, this is probably the time to really get this in writing and start telling some of these stories and put it into perspective.
I was struck as you went throughout the 1980s just how raw and how difficult those early years were. And I kind of want to work through that, but let's go back to June 5th, 1981. Again, you create this Infectious Diseases Other folder because who knows what you're looking at, right? Tell me what you were thinking when you were kind of going through that.
I read through the report, and, you know, infectious diseases, people think in terms of contagion and bugs and patterns of illness. So there were three or four bells that went off in my head that said, well, there's something that we need to keep an eye on here, which is why I filed it away rather than putting it in the trash. The other is that those cases were reported by my former medical student, Dr. Michael Gottlieb, who's credited with identifying that first group of cases.
As you say in the book, the student became the teacher for you there.
Exactly.
Didn't
it? It turned everything on its head, and my student became my teacher, and we've remained connected after all of these years, and he's still doing HIV work in Los Angeles. But at the time, it was better keep an eye on this, but I don't know what to call it. There was no name for it. It was just a pattern of illness.
Did I pronounce that correctly? Pneumocystis pneumonia?
Very good.
Which means what, by the way?
Pneumocystis is the organism. It's now classified as a bacterial infection. And it's seen in people whose immune systems aren't working. And prior to that, we had seen it only in transplant patients. Had never really seen it in otherwise healthy adults. And that was another red flag in terms of something different here.
Now, so you decided that you weren't going to toss that report aside, that you were going to keep an eye on it. But the medical community didn't all move in the same pace in those early years. What was the climate like in responding to trying to figure out what was actually happening and then dealing with it, Bill?
The sudden explosive nature of this whole thing, that all of a sudden previously healthy people were getting sick, and the numbers began to increase so that it looked like we were seeing something that hadn't been seen before. One of the problems is that no one was prepared for it. No one was truly prepared for the explosive piece of this. So we were all sort of scrambling in MASH unit fashion, as I've said, that tried to do a couple things at the same time. One was to try and understand what was going on. And then the other was to set up a system of care to deal with the sheer volume of it. And it wasn't just going on. That wasn't just happening in Rochester. That was happening eventually in thousands of communities all over the world.
But early on, you even say that, you know, you kind of deluded yourself into thinking, well, maybe it wasn't really in Rochester. This was a New York City, a San Francisco kind of a thing.
It's a big city thing where they have all kinds of problems in big cities, quote unquote. I mean, I tried to delude myself into thinking that, well, this really isn't a problem, until I couldn't do that anymore because the numbers just got to be too great, too many people that I knew infected and coming into the hospital, and just too many surprises for too many people in order to continue to deny that this is a problem of New York City.
And I want to read just an example of one of these early moments where it became undeniably real, for lack of a better term. Bill writes, not everyone went to the emergency department seeking care. Some people came directly to my office. One day, a high-profile man I knew from his community work popped into my office, which was sparsely furnished with a desk, two chairs, a file cabinet, some bookshelves. He was one of the first of many people to sit opposite me and tell me his story. As a young man, he had experimented with injecting drugs. It was only for a short time, and it was a long time ago. He was 40 years old now. His career was on the rise, and he was sick. I began to realize the enormity of what was happening. Like many people who sat in those chairs after him, he was looking for a lifeline. During the conversation, he apologized to me for his past behavior. And when he finished, we sat there in silence for what seemed like a very long time. I broke the silence then and reassured him that he didn't need to apologize. He needed medical care. Why was he apologizing? He was 40 years old and feeling like, how could I have done this?
Sure. Regretting that he had experimented with drugs, not knowing what it would lead to, a sense of guilt, anxiety that you sort of respond to within your own cultural framework. And AIDS at the time had even more of a stigma than it did today, because it was always associated with bad behavior.
You know, shame, stigma,
shaming people for their sexual behavior. And the other thing that it did is it forced people to acknowledge parts of themselves that they either chose to leave not discussed or leave behind them. And it, after a time, you couldn't do that. A lot of people tried to go into hiding, and we did our best to protect them as best we could. But at the same time, it forced a lot of people to face up to those kinds of things.
Now, when you say tried to go into hiding, I mean, you describe people who basically kind of vanished from society. They get this diagnosis. What did they do?
Leave and go home. so that if you talk to a lot of people, one was my friend who was the manager of the Grand Hyatt in New York, who describes his experience. What he said was that people were at work one day and gone the next. Now, a lot of those people came back to Rochester or other places to live with family and receive their medical care. We called that the homecoming phenomenon. Other people got sick very quickly and died.
But they kind of vanished to die.
Yeah.
You know, that we can't go in and tell our coworkers that here's my diagnosis. Sometimes can't even tell family. Or if families were told, sometimes families were split over this kind of a thing. I mean, it just sounded, especially in the 1980s, it sounded awful.
It was. It was. Certainly, I never experienced anything like that on such a large scale. The enormity of the medical problems, the social and family dynamics that either brought people together in better ways or unraveled completely. And the disappearance of people reminded me very much of my experience as a kid during the polio epidemic, when kids in my grade school class would disappear and end up in an iron lung.
Wow. Wow.
So it was my own history repeating myself, but it hit me over the head daily. And as an adult, watching that scenario unfold and having to try and respond to it,
well,
it was overwhelming.
Talking to Dr. Bill Valenti, whose new book is AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. You can get it at drvalenti.com or trilliumhealth.org. You can also go out next Wednesday, April 19th at 5:30 p.m. at the Apogee Wine Bar on Park Avenue for a book signing event there. And if you want, you can save the date for Saturday, July 8th. For the Trillium Health White Party. They always have a lot of fun with that. So a lot of chances to get access to this book that tells these stories in a way that I think certainly for most of us are not just reminders, but stories that we have never heard. And I think puts a real human face on AIDS and where it's going. And as we said, those early days, well, there was stigma, there was condemnation. And part of the condemnation came from occasionally, usually socially conservative people who thought that this was some kind of a judgment. And I'm sorry, Bill, but I'm going to read from a number of places in your book this hour, because one of these events happened at WXXI. Bill writes that, you know, he was doing a lot of media, a lot of interviews, a lot of events trying to help. And this was, I think, in 1987. Mm-hmm. And he writes, I did a monthly live discussion on AIDS on WXXI. One Friday evening, I was paired with a representative from a local conservative group. One of the group's positions was that AIDS was divine punishment for homosexual behavior. So I swung into action, culture war style. I had met him before. We had appeared on the air together, and we always disagreed on the issues. It was no different with this broadcast, the last segment of a year-long series. I think we all felt the tension in the studio. When we were off the air, the lights on the set were still on us, and the camera crew and moderator stood in back in the dark. Now, for some reason, we remained seated, and I said something like, you were really hitting below the belt tonight. Your approach to the AIDS problem offers no solutions. It doesn't go anywhere. Well, he looked at me and listened, and then I started to overheat. And to make my point, I shouted, why don't you do something productive for a change? If you're such a decent person, why don't you give me some money to send my dying patient and her children to Disney World? End quote. And it kind of worked, didn't it, Bill? What happened?
He looked at me and he said, if I give you the money, will you give it to her? And of course, by that time, I was completely overheated. I stood up and screamed at him, of course I would give it to her. And then he gave me $50. And I stood there for a minute. Actually, that was what I was hoping he would do.
But were you surprised?
I was surprised of the whole about the whole dynamic. What surprised me more than anything, though, was that on the way home, I was thinking that, you know, even though we disagreed 180 degrees on every issue, for a minute, we were able to find some common ground. The story of my dying patient, a young woman that we sent to Disney World with her mother and two children, and she died 6 months later, had a very nice trip, and people in the community donated money, including my friend from WXXI Studio. So, yeah, it did surprise me. In fact, what surprised me as much as him giving me the money was my ability to compromise that far for just a minute to take it from him, to convince him that this was worth it. So that the common ground thing is something that it's carried with me over the years in terms of, you know, you can't have it your way completely. That there has to be some sort of compromise or give and take here. And of course, for me, finding that kind of common ground can be difficult.
Well, because, you know, there's part of you that might be thinking, I can't take money, even $50, from a guy who thinks AIDS is divine punishment for homosexual behavior.
Well,
but you said that common ground, maybe we can find some common ground.
Yes, and even though we disagree widely on the issues, if you offered me the money to help the cause, then I'll take it. That was sort of a watershed moment for me, because up until then I had planned on, or I thought that the only way to really deal with these kinds of issues is to dig your heels in completely and never listen to the other side. And that's just not the way it is.
Well, that was 30 years ago. How often today do you hear that same sentiment that, you know, that AIDS is divine punishment or you know, these diseases, these afflictions, that God is against this? I mean, we've seen a real evolution in this country since those days in the WXXI studio in 1987 on same-sex marriage, on, you know, just celebrating different parts of culture instead of stigmatizing, haven't we?
We have indeed, and as a result of it, the AIDS advocacy movement, LGBT people have increased visibility, and certainly legislation has also created a friendlier environment. However, there's still stigma associated with LGBT people and certainly HIV and AIDS, so it hasn't gone away completely. And I think there are two major themes here that intersect, that I think create that. One is sex. And the other is fear of contagion. While we're better at understanding how HIV is transmitted, I think it's still mysterious to a lot of people.
By the way, that story, raising money for that trip, the woman, Mary, who did get to go to Disney World, mm-hmm. because of the support of the community, she died, as Bill writes, 6 months later. And you write, in 2016, you bumped into Minnie Mouse. What happened?
She returned from her trip just as happy as can be, handed me a gift, which was a Minnie Mouse decal in an envelope. So we smiled and hugged, and I had forgotten that I put the decal on a door in the basement. And last year when I was prowling around trying to find something, I looked up and there was Minnie Mouse staring at me from the door in the basement. So I thought about Mary and wrote the story.
You know, there's probably, even if it's not all Minnie Mouse stickers, a lot of little mementos or things over the years. How often are you reminded of patients you've lost?
Oh, my gosh. A lot. A lot. Seeing their, when we reminisce or talk about it, I talk about it in the book, talking to Dr. Steve Scheibel or Dr. Ann Griep, when we talk about patients, I can see their faces. And Dr. Scheibel once said that I've never forgotten any of those early patients, that he can see them and he can hear them, that it's something that's just seared into your brain. It doesn't leave you. It is, the experience is unlike any other. And I think it's the enormity of the whole experience, the, as I said, explosive nature and the scale of it. And what we were doing in Rochester, relatively small numbers, was reproduced in thousands of places throughout the world. So we were part of a much larger movement. And traveling, going abroad, going to other places, and seeing how other people are dealing with this really changes your perspective on the impact of some of these health issues and what's needed to, what I say, the term I use is manage an epidemic. Managing an epidemic is hard work.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the human part of the work of just understanding when someone may die. And so first I want to talk about what you wrote in a section of the book on the paper boy, and the, your broader feelings about having to confront the fact that a patient may die. And then how a diagnosis has changed 30, 35 years later compared to what it meant in the 1980s. But this is what you wrote in that section on the paperboy. In a moment, if you want, you can explain who the paperboy was. But you write this, quote, "It was always difficult for me to face the reality of impending death. The experience of most of my patients dying before their parents was upside down. It wasn't supposed to happen that way. What do you say to a mother whose 26-year-old is going to die? What do you say to any mother whose kid is about to die at any age? It gave me a sick feeling at the pit of my stomach. I wanted to find a way to keep him alive, and I couldn't," end quote. Who was the paperboy?
The paperboy was a patient, but he lived in the neighborhood where I grew up, and my mother still lived down the street. So when he got sick, I began to make house calls. I would stop at my mother's house and have lunch with her. Then I would walk to his house and make a house call. I had been in his house many, many times as a teenager because a friend of mine from high school lived there. But it was different now because I was visiting a patient. And, you know, I was thinking about it this morning that story of all of the stories is the one that really stays with me because of I was thinking about in healthcare, we're supposed to be perfect and cure people and never fail. And the trouble with HIV in the early days was that we were failing constantly. If the goal was to keep people alive, we weren't doing so well. Now, if we were to help change people's lives and support them through a terrible illness and try and unite them with their families and make them comfortable, we did very well. But the idea of our training is, your medical training is cure them. And there was no cure. So I was constantly second-guessing myself. And with every death like this, feeling like I had somehow disappointed the patient and his family and that I was a failure. So the second-guessing part was a big part of the learning curve for me in order to put this whole thing into perspective and be better balanced in terms of what it was I was trying to do and what I could actually accomplish.
And not only then confront that, you know, all you can do maybe is comfort someone, especially in those early years, but then seeing what would happen to their family. I mean, this was, obviously now, AIDS is not just a quote-unquote gay disease, but it had that stigma at the time, and yes, it certainly impacted a lot of gay people. And then what would happen to the family dynamics? Well, I go back to page 19. This paragraph blew me away. You write, "Family dynamics created additional conflict with gay couples. Another of our earliest patients died and left a partner of 15 years. They lived comfortably, and his partner was his caregiver until he died. The patient's family asserted their legal right to manage the dead man's affairs. The locks were changed on the doors of their house, and the partner was then homeless. The partner survived for a while, but he couldn't cope. He later committed suicide, despite our best efforts to guide him through his new reality. The collateral damage of the era was harsh and overwhelming, at times brutal," end quote. I have to believe that story wouldn't happen today, would it, Bill?
Less so. It does happen.
Wow.
It does happen. Family dynamics in a time of crisis, especially with applying a layer of stigma and maybe fear of contagion, sends people thinking in different directions. I mean, what am I saying here? What I'm saying is that, yeah, it still happens. The difference is, I think it happens less so because we have much more information than we had in the old days. In the beginning, when that story unfolded, we knew very little about even how the disease was transmitted. So a lot of what we were trying to do in terms of rebuilding families and helping people make connections and get through this was like shooting in the dark.
But you've got this couple, and one person in the couple is a caregiver. I mean, this isn't just a couple that's been together for 15 years. Mm-hmm. You are caregiving someone as they die. Yeah. And within days of their death, their family changes the locks.
Yeah. So I think what that speaks to is cloudy judgment and how cloudy that judgment can be under times of great stress because, you know, HIV does have a different image and view today, probably because the medicines are so much better and people live so much longer. So the fear of contagion and the big stigma. And the other is LGBT relationships, same-sex relationships. We're really in a different place culturally in that era. So there were also times when people didn't want to talk about that kind of relationship and kept it private, and families in some ways decided, well, maybe I can erase that whole chapter if I just take over, change the locks, and get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, when people say the closet can kill you, I mean, this is what they're talking about.
Out of sight, out of mind.
And so you touch a little bit in the book, by the way, about how things started to change, particularly in the 1990s. What did you think of the film Philadelphia?
Wow. First of all, it was like going to work, watching it. It was really painful. And Jack Garner, who interviewed us after the viewing, everybody talked about their emotions, and I gave him a little bit of a more educational tone to my reaction, but I thought it was really hard to watch because it brought all of those terrible things into focus, but it was 15 or more years after the epidemic started. And here is a young Philadelphia lawyer being fired from his job for not only being gay, but for having AIDS. And watching him die in this movie was really painful to watch because it was true. We had seen that same scenario hundreds of times. And to watch it on the screen was like being hit over the head.
But that's a compliment to the reality that the film portrayed, isn't it?
Oh, wow. Extraordinary. And the music, the Maria Callas arias are just... I'm getting speechless here. It's a must watch. You have to see it.
Do you think it had an impact?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And you know what? Even though Garner said, well, it's 15 years too late, it wasn't too late because it still reminds us of the human condition and destigmatizing. And it's not just about gay people and AIDS. You can apply it to any contemporary cultural issue that you want. You'll see a lot in it. It's a beautiful film.
Talking to Dr. Bill Valenti, and Dr. William Valenti's book is called AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. You can get it now at drvalenti.com or trilliumhealth.org. All the proceeds benefit Trillium Health's End the HIV Epidemic by 2020 Fund. There's a book signing event next Wednesday night. That's the 19th, 5:30 p.m. at Apogee Wine Bar on Park Avenue. So Dr. Valenti will be there. You can pick up the books there. Or if you want, you can save the date for July 8th. For the Trillium Health White Party at the Winter Garden in downtown Rochester. They always have fun with that. You can also find them on Facebook at Trillium Health. Let's get our only break of the hour. More stories to share, and we're going to turn this in a... I mean, this has been tough to talk about, but I think really important. But we're going to turn this in a different direction as we talk about how a diagnosis has changed. I mean, imagine sitting in those early years with patients who say, what is this? Or probably occasionally saying to Bill, tell me this isn't AIDS, or am I going to die, versus what that kind of conversation might sound like today. We'll also share more stories from the book coming up after our only break of the hour. And let me tell you what's coming up Wednesday on the next Connections. We preview Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School's spring lecture series. It's called When I Was in Prison, Restoring Dignity and Justice. We'll sit down with a few of the speakers to talk about the themes of social justice and reforming the incarceration system. Then in our second hour, Rochester's home to the nation's largest deaf population per capita. We'll talk with members of the deaf community about deaf culture, misconceptions that hearing people have, and challenges faced by the deaf community. Welcome back to Connections. And by the way, if you find value in today's conversation with Dr. Valenti, you might be interested in future discussions about medicine and healthcare, including WXXI's upcoming episodes of our national medical show, Second Opinion. You can be a member of the live audience when the show films in May. For more information and tickets, go to wxxi.org/secondopinion tickets if you want to be part of that. Dr. Valenti's book is AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. How often did those office visits have people saying, you know, tell me it's not AIDS, or I don't even know, you know, what is this? You know, that kind of fear in those early days, if the medical community wasn't entirely sure what caused it or what was going on, what was the fear like in patients?
Oh, it was tremendous. because in the beginning, people were very likely to die and knew what was going to happen. So that delivering the news was a hard part of the job. The hardest part of the job, though, was for the patient. You know, I write that I was the catalyst, but the patients did the heavy lifting here, and I really do believe that. The patients and their families were the ones who had to do it. I was the cheerleader, catalyst, whatever you want to call me. And I'll take the credit for trying to invent certain kinds of new therapies, which Dr. Scheibel and I did a lot, to try and stay ahead of it. So we worked the art of medicine as best we could. I'll tell you one thing that I, the way I approached that with patients who said, am I going to die or what now, doc? Mm-hmm. And I never said that we had run out of options. I just couldn't do that. Instead, my mantra was, and I believed it, and I still believe it, is there's always something we can do. We'll do something. We don't just pack it up here and go home.
But you weren't concerned that would give false hope?
Well, with something like that where you don't know all the answers and we're just getting our feet wet, I didn't think so, because we had very good relationships with people. I didn't want to overpromise, but,
sure.
You know, one example is the guy who had terrible disfiguring, the Kaposi's sarcoma on his face, who had trouble swallowing. We couldn't get rid of the cancer, but we helped him swallow.
I think that's Adam, if I remember correctly,
yep.
From the book.
And he was grateful for that, for being able to improve his swallowing so that he didn't have to eat alone.
You know, that's exactly what you were talking about when you say that at times in those early years, you might not be able to cure it, but sometimes you have to make their life better. And you write that Adam improved his speech therapy, teaching him how to swallow. And one day during an office visit, he looked at me and smiled. He told me that his swallowing had improved, the drooling had stopped, and he was enjoying eating again with his family.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't preserve his life for much longer than that, but
that's
a very big thing for someone to have those moments with their family before they die.
It's a huge thing. And if you're going only for the cure, which is certainly noble and need to at least be looking in that direction, but at the same time, I wanted to make sure I didn't miss any other opportunities to at least make it better for people.
And now the difference now, someone comes in now with this kind of a diagnosis, and what's the conversation like?
The conversation is, well, the medicines are more convenient. We can give you all three drugs in that cocktail and one pill once a day instead of 24 pills a day. So that's good news. We have a test that monitors, tells us how the drugs are working. It can tell us how much virus is in your blood. And if you take your medicine as directed, you will live almost as long today as someone without HIV.
Isn't that truly remarkable?
I'm almost speechless again. Yeah. I had, in the early days, had no idea that we would be having this kind of conversation this way. What it does is it shows you what $5 billion a year can do in terms of managing an epidemic with spillover, not only in HIV, but into cancer and targeted therapies and a whole bunch of other things that we've learned as a result of this. So a lot happened in a very short period of time.
Would you say now to someone who says, am I going to die? I mean, those early years, you'd have to say, there's always something we can do. We can keep trying. You know, you don't want to overpromise, but you want to keep working. What do you say now if someone says, am I going to die?
I had that conversation with somebody last year, a 20-year-old guy who is newly infected. And we sort of picked him up very, very early. And I told him something, what we just said about living a long time, convenient medication, and because of his young age, reminded him that right now we're talking about lifelong treatment. And also talking about the importance of taking this medicine every single day. Because what I just told you about living a long time and doing well and being healthy applies only if you take the medicine. And then I referred him to the social worker, getting him some mental health therapy, talking about partner kinds of things to make sure the partner stays HIV negative. So it's a very different dynamic today. But the question that he asked me when we were talking about his test was, am I going to die? He said the same thing that people have been asking me for 35 years. What's the point? Well, there's still a feeling out there thinking that this is a pretty terrible disease. And it is. If we can keep people negative and keep them from getting infected, I'd say that's really important and we need to be focusing on that. When we can't do that, though, we need to step in early. And there's a lot more science there in terms of what that early treatment would do for the long haul, because there are some people who may not even need to take drugs for the long haul if we get started early enough. Point is that the advances in our understanding have been truly, truly remarkable.
I think I was 13, 14 years old when I saw HBO's And the Band Played On. That was even before Philadelphia, I think.
Yes.
And Jim in Rochester called in to ask if you'd seen the movie. Jim says he has HIV. He'd like to know if Bill has seen And the Band Played On. He says the meditation practices have helped him. So that has been a boon for him, meditation. But have you seen the film?
Yes.
I say HIV, HBO. I think it was an HBO film, like 1993
or something. Randy Schultz wrote the book several years before that. I've seen the movie and read the book. And that's also true to life, because what the Schultz narrative is about is the early response to HIV, the early federal response in the Reagan administration to HIV, and he gives them a pretty scathing review. I glossed over it a little tiny bit, but at the same time, the response in Washington was schizophrenic, because while there was no money for care, there was still some money being pumped in on the side into federal research. So we were able to get some things moving, but The Band Played On is also sobering and accurate. Regarding meditation, if it works and makes you feel better and helps with getting through this, by all means. And there are other things in terms of walking, exercise, proper diet, a whole variety of things that are, we call adjunctive, that are very important.
Jim, thanks for the phone call. Good luck to you. Can we tell the story a little bit of Fritz and Ramona? You know, that was a story that I thought really stood out to me in the book, because, well, first of all, you said, you know, Fritz, Phyllis Hagestein?
Hagestein.
You said the word guts comes to mind with Fritz. And you also said that, especially with the assumptions about what AIDS is, who it impacts, how it impacts them, you know, Fritz turned the story on its head. So tell me about Fritz and Ramona.
Well, up until that time, most patients were men who had sex with men or gay men. And Fritz was a woman who, when you talk about how did she get it, well, it was heterosexually acquired. Interesting, though, about Fritz is that her mother came to appointments with her. And you sort of watch the generations, and I could see a lot of Ramona, mother, in Phyllis, or Fritz, as we called her. And she decided that she wanted to give a voice to, she wanted to tell the story the way it really was. The point is, it doesn't matter about heterosexual transmission or any of that. What her message was is that women get HIV as well. This isn't just a gay man's disease or someone who injects drugs. Wake up, people, was her message. And she and Tony Obermeyer, a friend and advocate, went out and did a lot of media and TV and educational programs. And the three of them, along with grandmother Ramona, were really this three-point powerhouse of people who were determined she was absolutely determined to get the message out there, because up until then, as we point out in the book, is that people with AIDS, especially women, were underground, couldn't reveal their status for fear of loss of housing, insurance, employment, family stigma.
But they weren't getting the medical care.
Well, that's one thing we did, was we encouraged people, all right, so if you're going to be in hiding and not talk to anybody about your diagnosis.
We don't judge.
Correct. This is why Community Health Network at the time was was different, because it didn't matter who you were. The idea was, this is where you get medical care, and we accept you the way you are. We'll work with you the way you are. But because the importance of medical care became clear to me very early, even though we had no drugs, we did have a way of monitoring people so that we had a little sense of what was going on while we were waiting for the drugs to become available.
And how do you think of Fritz and Ramona now, by the way?
Oh, God. Well, I've known three generations of that family. Her daughter is very active in what we do at Trillium Health. And I still think of them as, I think of the courage of people like Fritz going out there and confronting people and trying to change their minds and educate them about what was going on. That really did take guts, because it was done at a time when it was highly discouraged and people with AIDS weren't widely embraced. Remember, she had two young children. And in the other story, the story of the woman who went to Disney World, she also talked in her newspaper interview about how she was stigmatized, how people laughed at her where she lived. And it was only 60 miles away from here. So the thing is, if you're sick, you don't need to be stigmatized at the same time. It's a drag on getting better and getting medical care and keeping your health.
When it comes to that stigma over the years, there are a number of people who kind of pop up in your book. What was the impact of Bishop Matthew Clark?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. He and Larry Chesson, Dr. Lawrence Chesson, are my heroes. John Washburn is another. What Bishop Clark did was he defined his ministry as being open to everyone, the God's children piece. And there were several pivotal moments during the AIDS crisis where he did a mass for gay and lesbian Catholics who were having a regional meeting in Rochester. So the LGBT community came onto the radar screen. And also did a mass for people with AIDS and their families. And, you know, my faith had waned at that point. So it was something that I think a lot of us needed to restore faith and kind of have a different perspective on what was going on. And I still remember that experience and how I felt at the time. But at a time when there were essentially no religious leaders who had stepped up to the plate, Bishop Clark first started his writings on embracing people with AIDS came very early, and two masses followed several years later.
Bill, do you know, I mean, did he reach out and ask the medical community about it? How did this come to him to care about it?
Well, I think it's within his own framework of being not only a person of faith, but a religious leader responsible for overseeing in this area, a nine-county area of the faithful, if you will.
But you know that in various communities, not just religious communities, and I'm not going to try to broad brush it, but there are some leaders who not only didn't want to hold a mass for people with AIDS and their families,
sure.
but also said, I kind of agree with the person who was in the WXXI studio with Bill in 1987. Maybe this is God's judgment. It's a wide range. And
yes.
there are people from all different backgrounds in the religious community. But Bishop Clark might have been taking a bit of a risk with that.
Oh, he was indeed.
Yeah.
Because that his positions and his thinking were not something that everyone of the faithful agreed with. So what's my answer? Well, he's obviously enlightened. In other words, somebody who can see the much bigger picture and in line. We had met over the years at a variety of meetings and activities, and he was a part of, in fact, the diocese, the Catholic Diocese of Rochester, established a series of programs through Catholic Charities. Very, very early in the epidemic. We gave him an award last year at Trillium Health, and he said, he quoted Pope Francis, who said that the church in the time of health crisis is like a field hospital during wartime. And if you look at it through a wide lens, you can understand why and how he ended up being in a pivotal part of what we were doing. I'll tell you, personally, it was just what I needed at that time.
And you say he's really a personal hero to you.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Broke down a lot of barriers.
Talking to Dr. William Valenti, whose new book is AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir, and I'd be remiss if we didn't at least ask the question that I think I ask Bill every time he's here, but our listeners always want to know. You know, when we talk about a cure, where are we now? You know, this idea of end AIDS by 2020, how realistic? How do you answer those questions now?
Ending AIDS by 2020, ending the epidemic means we're going to treat ourselves out of it, meaning reduce new infections to under 750 a year statewide. And we're on track. If we don't get to 750 statewide, we'll come very close because there's a lot of activity in New York State to do this. Federally, there's an initiative to do the same thing around by 2020 as well. But that's managing it with drugs and preventing new infections. The treatment or cure part, a ways away. Also, HIV vaccine, sometime in the future. But then again, look at where we were 35 years ago and look at where we are today. I expect that, well, I was going to say, if you invite me back in 10 years, all right, 5 years, we'll have some significant things to be talking about. Science is progressing at a very rapid rate. Is it possible? I wouldn't say no.
What do you think is more likely, a vaccine or a cure?
Vaccine.
Okay.
Because the technology is there. We have 100 years of vaccine history in this world.
Yeah.
Eradicating virus from the cells of individuals is a lot more complicated.
But we're going to get to a vaccine, you think, maybe even in the next decade.
Yes. I'll go out on a limb there. Because vaccine research is moving ahead at a very rapid clip. The cure, eradication from the body, more complicated.
The vaccine landscape, it has had some weird times in recent years. It's had some mm-hmm. misinformation. You know, you still have people who are convinced that vaccines cause the disease they purport to prevent. What do you think it's going to be like if there's an HIV vaccine, given some of that climate out there, Bill?
Well, I think there'll be pockets of either people who doubt that the vaccine works or its origins, or as you said, there's some conspiracy associated mm-hmm. with vaccine. Let me speak, though, from observing a good part of the last 50 years of vaccine history is that I am truly a believer. The conflict, though, might come from, well, this is a sexually transmitted infection, so where does that fit within our personal and cultural framework? We've seen, we had a little taste of that with the HPV, the human papilloma vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I think, I expect that we'll see some of that. But when you think about preventing a deadly disease, I guess I'd ask people, well, how do you want to handle this for your children and your grandchildren?
Got about a minute left with Dr. William Valenti, and the book is AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, A Doctor's Memoir. You can get it now at drvalenti.com, trilliumhealth.org. He's got a book signing next Wednesday, the 19th at 5:30 at Apogee Wine Bar on Park Avenue. Got a chance to meet him there. And what's been the most rewarding part of this entire book process for you? I mean, you've had to really reopen a lot of chapters in your life and in your history here, Bill.
Well, that's the part is searching, sort of digging deep into my own head, maybe understanding myself a little bit better. But I'll tell you, the most rewarding part is reflecting on the humanity of the response, the community response, that there have been very few people over the years who have declined to have an appointment with me. That in the very, very beginning, people asked and were willing to invest in an organization like Community Health Network that didn't exist. It was an idea. But people wanted to do something about HIV and did it. Remarkable, remarkable community we live in.
Well, and a testament to him, Carlene called off-air to say that Dr. Valenti is a treasure to the community and a hero to thousands of people.
Thank you.
And I know a lot of people feel that way. The book is available now. All of the proceeds benefit Trillium Health's End the HIV Epidemic by 2020 Fund. TrilliumHealth.org for more information. And Dr. Valenti, it's always a great conversation. The book really, for me, hit me in ways I didn't even expect. Thank you for doing this, and thank you for being here. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack as the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll catch up with you on Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.